Hello, this is a podcast from SCC English, the English department of St. Columba's College, Dublin in Ireland. Visit our blog at sccenglish.ie. Welcome to SCC English podcast number 8. This is Julian Girdham from St. Columba's College in Dublin with our 5th revision podcast on Macbeth leading up to the Leaving Certificate. Today I'll be discussing the supernatural. For such an action-packed drama, full of thunder and lightning, blood and guts, murder and massacre, the play Macbeth is peculiarly theological. The deepest concern Macbeth has is his own soul, the thought of the deep damnation of Duncan's taking off. And the tragedy is the inevitable and relentless debasing of that soul. As the Doctor puts it in the sleepwalking scene, unnatural deeds do breed unnatural troubles. And this is nowhere more catastrophically so than within Macbeth's own spirit. The play plants itself fully in the middle of the clash between good and evil. When we settle into our seats to watch this drama for the first time, without knowing the story, we're confronted with the most extraordinary scene. To the background of thunder and lightning, three rather low-life female creatures are muttering a series of obscure rhyming couplets. They're the sort of people most of us would move quickly past on the street, keeping our eyes firmly fixed ahead and holding our noses. Just what are they? As the first characters we see in the first scene of the story, they have an immediate and powerful impact on us. Imagine the lesser impact they would have if, for instance, the play began with Act 1, Scene 2, and the Captain's Report, and we only saw the witches for the first time when they met Macbeth on the heath. That first scene defines the mood of the play. And this is the challenge for you in writing on the witches and the supernatural in the play. We live in a largely post-religious society, certainly one in which the idea of active evil is distinctly unfashionable. In a production, the danger is that the witches are more likely to provoke giggling than fear. Figures like the young crone of Putney, visited in the second series of Blackadder by Edmund as he looks for the wise woman. There's a link on SCC English on May the 17th if you haven't seen this. If you're writing about the supernatural in your exam, the key thing to get right is your understanding about the relationship between the supernatural and the human, specifically and vitally, the influence on Macbeth himself. So let me lay it on the line here. A reading that lays blame on the witches or other supernatural forces is one which diminishes or even wipes out the tragedy. This is just the same as Lady Macbeth dealt with in the second revision podcast. If she controls him, then he's not a proper or even interesting object for tragedy. So I'll be arguing that the witches are catalysts, that the full focus of the tragedy has to be in Macbeth's own actions and thoughts. Witches are not, of course, the only elements of the supernatural, and I'll discuss some others. The witches don't appear that much in the play, or rather the weird sisters don't, since they neither call each other witches nor are referred to as such by anyone else in the play. Weird is the Old English for fate. But from the first scene, they're enormously powerful for us as an audience. They're immediately associated with darkness and confusion, encapsulated by the famous final two lines of Act 1, Scene 1, "Fair is foul, and foul is fair, hover through the fog and filthy air." We might take this as a warning. Nothing about them will be clear, and Macbeth finds this out to his cost later. An hour or two later, in Act 1, Scene 3, they place themselves on the heath in Macbeth and Banquo's way. Before they arrive, the first witch has significant words, in which she talks about the tormenting of the master of the ship, the Tiger. She's going to drain him dry as hay, and "sleep shall neither night nor day hang upon his penthouse lid. He shall live, a man forbid, weary 7 nights, 9 times 9, shall he dwindle, peak and pine. Though his bark cannot be lost, yet it shall be tempest-tossed." The parallels with what happens to Macbeth later are obvious. He is also a man for whom sleep becomes impossible in his post-murder nightmare, and who eventually dwindles away to nothingness. But although this sister can prompt the conditions for the sailor's misery, she cannot destroy his ship. Macbeth's first words startle us in their echo of that first scene. So foul and fair a day I have not seen. And as an audience, we know already that his fate will be deeply bound up with them. Banquo's words emphasize again just how confusing these figures are, looking not like the inhabitants of the earth, yet being on it, apparently women, yet disconcertingly hairy. And then comes the single most important line in the story, the one that sets everything off, and the one without which we would not have the story we do. It's given to the third witch. All hail Macbeth, that shalt be king hereafter. Macbeth says nothing for 20 lines, yet inside him, as we soon learn, his life has just taken its definitive turn. Tony Nuttall, in his 2007 book Shakespeare the Thinker, from which I'm now going to quote extensively, calls this moment the most economical feat of dramaturgy, in other words, theatrical technique, ever. The place where most is done in least time. It lasts less than a second. Shakespeare makes sure we don't miss this minute bodily reaction by making Macbeth's companion say, "Why do you start and seem to fear things which sound so fair?" What does the start mean? Some say that it simply signifies surprise. Others more shrewdly say, no, it means recognition. If he had been merely surprised, Macbeth would have said, in Jacobean English, "Why on earth do you say that?" The companion, Banquo, is himself puzzled, as he would never have been by simple amazement, and detects a note of fear. Macbeth's start means, how do they know that I have already thought about this happening? Nuttall then contrasts this play to Othello, in which Iago drives the hero towards a jealousy he would not all otherwise develop, and says, "This time the crucial element, ambition, clearly pre-exists the moment of external activation. The effect of the prophecy of the weird sisters is simply to translate thought into action. They are a trigger. A gun is fired that might have remained safely in the cupboard." And Nuttall then goes on to write, "It all started with the babble of the weird sisters. One could imagine a version of the play in which there were no witches, but Lady Macbeth, as prompter, worked on her husband until she made him murder Duncan. But Shakespeare makes the movement start from a humanly unrelated external stimulus. The weird sisters are not political experts pursuing a certain design. They are primitive organisms, grinning and chattering, witlessly rhyming out their habitual predictions." And then later Nuttall goes on to say that, quote, "The weird sisters trigger a pre-existing tendency in Macbeth's mind. They are telling a man to do something he had already considered doing, something he partly wants to do in any case." Nuttall says that after this initial prompting, Macbeth gradually becomes, quote, "a bloody primitive organism. It is as if Shakespeare has become interested in how small a thing, how simple a thing, could impinge from outside and radically transform the sequence of events. When biologists speak of giving a stimulus to a developing organism, outsiders often assume some complex process must be involved, and do not realize that a prod with a small metal object will do the trick. What the weird sisters do to Macbeth is oddly like what a practiced hypnotist can do to a subject. The trigger can be trivial in itself, but its power is astonishing." And so back to Act 1, Scene 3. Macbeth calls the witch's words supernatural soliciting, and his first soliloquy shows clearly that he's entirely aware of the dangers here, but he still can't control his excited fantasizing. "If ill, why hath it given me earnest of success?" It's left to Banquo to make the definitive statement on dabbling with the supernatural. Oftentimes, to win us to our harm, the instruments of darkness tell us truths, win us with honest trifles, to betray us in deepest consequence. These may well be the most perceptive words in the play, Lady Macbeth, the subject of our second podcast, certainly doesn't have these scruples or doubts. In the famous Act 1, Scene 5, she actively calls on the spirits that tend on mortal thoughts to unsex me here, and fill from the crown to the toe top full of direst cruelty, actively encouraging the murdering ministers and sightless substances. I won't analyse the crucial Act 1, Scene 7 here, since that was the subject of the first podcast, but you do need to look carefully at it. His horror in that soliloquy is theological. He knows that his soul will be destroyed by the deep damnation of Duncan's taking off, and he's right. By Act 2, Scene 1, the full terror of his impending act coheres in the opening dagger soliloquy. He knows he's about to meddle with forces beyond the natural, and that, quote, o'er the one half world nature seems dead, and wicked dreams abuse the curtained sleep. Witchcraft celebrates pale Hecate's offerings. But it's worth pointing out the obvious, that there aren't any witches around pushing him on now. He just doesn't need any more prompting. This sense of the unnatural taking a hold is developed further in Act 2, Scene 3, in the surprising and rather unlikely figure of an irritated chatterbox looking after the gate to the castle. The porter's words again drip with theological significance as he jokes about being porter of Hellgate, saying that this place is too cold for hell. Have a look at his words about drink and how it provokes and unprovokes lechery, how it equivocates him in a sleep and, giving him the lie, leaves him. This is just what the witches do, provoking Macbeth's ambition, stirring him up, but leaving him to a life of disastrous disappointment as he acts out on the initial excitement. In Act 4, Scene 1, he seeks out the witches, ready to hear only what he wants to hear. And finally, when told by Macduff that he was born by a caesarean section, exclaims in Act 5, Scene 8, accursed be that tongue that tells me so, for it hath cowed my better part of man. And be these juggling fiends no more believed that palter with us in a double sense, that keep the word of promise to our ear and break it to our hope. Of course, they didn't really promise anything of the sort, because it wasn't in their power to give it to him. The supernatural appears in horrifying form, although only to Macbeth, at the banquet. Act 3, Scene 4, when Macbeth realizes fully the implications of his attempt to subvert the natural order. The time has been that when the brains were out, the man would die and there an end, but now they rise again. And as a result, he determines to plunge on recklessly and seek out the witches. After all, what more does he have to lose, now that he's lost his own soul? I'm in blood, stepped in so far, that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as go o'er. I'm going to leave aside Act 3, Scene 5, the Hecate appearance, a scene most people accept was not written by Shakespeare, and move on to the most famous scene involving the Weird Sisters, Act 4, Scene 1. It's well known not so much for the appearance of the apparitions and the line of kings, as for the opening 38 lines, as the witches gleefully fire all sorts of nasty things into their cauldron, and for the refrain, double, double, toil and trouble. The ideas of doubleness and troubleness are indeed at the heart of the play. As Fintan O'Toole points out, quote, if Macbeth is a man in transition, then the things that speed him to his doom are the transitional things of rituals. The witches are half human, half otherworldly, their brew full of those slippery reptilian creatures that have altered significance because they are neither one thing nor the other, neither fish nor flesh, but slip between the categories. Toads, snakes, newts, frogs, bats, adders, blind worms, lizards. But by this stage, Macbeth is too far gone to be bothered by the slipperiness of the apparition statements. He is like the second murderer, reckless what I do to spite the world. And so he calls the prophets sweet bodements and plunges further into the abyss. Next week, I'll look at the end of the play. But in any case, by this stage, there isn't much more to say about the witches or the influence of the supernatural. Macbeth's a runaway train by now. In the words of the critic G.K. Hunter, "Evil does not become alive or actual until it is endorsed by the will, say the moral theologians." And so it is in Macbeth. The play begins with the witches, and the witches must be supposed to be evil, but the mode of evil they can create is potential only, not actual, till the human agent takes it inside his mind and makes it his own by a motion of the will." End quote. Macbeth has indeed taken that potential and fulfilled it, and he has no one to blame but himself.